Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 2.
So hello, assalamu alaikum everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of CDPR's podcast series, Let's Talk Development. My name is Maha Qasim. I'm the CEO of Zero Point Partners, which is a sustainability advisory and consulting firm based in Pakistan. We work with development partners as well as private sector on climate resilience, sustainability strategies, reporting and disclosure. And our guest here today is Mr. Yasir Hussain, who is the director of the Climate Action Center Karachi, which works on decisive solutions to climate priorities. So welcome, Yasir. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So our topic for today is spatial vulnerabilities in cities. And essentially what this refers to is the susceptibility of specific geographic areas within a city with regards to various hazards, including natural disasters, and of course, climate change impacts and social and economic disruptions as well. So today we'll dive deep into a little reasons why, you know, certain cities or certain geographies within cities are more vulnerable than others. And Yasir, I guess our first question to you is, you know, what are spatial vulnerabilities and how do they manifest in a city like Karachi, you know, which is extremely populated, urbanized, it's urbanizing every day as we speak, and particularly in the context of climate change?
Thanks, Maha. It's kind of my favorite subject to talk about, where Karachi is located. Because now we're talking about climate, and essentially we started talking about nature. And the landscape around Karachi, where it's located, is such a specific and such a unique place. Because on one side, we have the Indus Delta, it touches Karachi, so that's the mangroves, and it stretches all the way into India. So this is a 375-kilometer border, which starts right at Karachi, and the thickest forest is right next to Karachi. Then on one side, you have the Balochistan Desert, and then literally Karachi is located at the foothills of Balochistan, and on that side, on the western side. And then south of Karachi is the sea, the ocean, which is again, you know, open to the world. So we have a very interesting place, and we've got these three different, you know, desert and forest and then sea. So I think everything, you know, as we go on talking about it, so we'll see that, you know, it kind of the city as it developed, it was a fishing village, then became a small trading town. Then when the British arrived here in 1843, this was added to the British Empire later in Sepanga. And then, you know, the transformation of that little town into a star port city of Karachi. This was, you know, everything that had to be shipped to Manchester would come down through the railways, and then would be shipped, and then it would come back here and then go to, you know, rest of India. So it was this beautiful city. It was known for its very mild weather, not too hot, and the great breeze that we get from the sea. And we still have that despite climate change. So go ahead. I mean, that's kind of lays out, you know, where we are.
Right. So you mentioned basically how the city has evolved, since the early colonial times. And, you know, what we're seeing today is a very different city from what maybe it was, it started out as, like, let's say, in the journey of the city and how it's evolved. So could you maybe tell us a little bit about some of the climate change impacts that we've already observed in Karachi over the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years? And, what are some of the current gaps that currently exist in data collection? I mean, of course, we've seen, you know, climate disasters of immense magnitude, like the heat wave of 2015. We've seen the urban flooding that happened in 2021. And of course, the monsoon and steroids that happened in 2022. Then, of course, you know, the weather patterns are changing. Sometimes we do get a bit of winter smog as well, despite, of course, our sea breeze. But increasingly, air pollution has also become a problem. So if you could just maybe speak to some of the already observed climate impacts, and talk about a little bit about this urban heat island effect that we're getting in the context of, you know, a built-up city like Karachi. And you mentioned the role of nature, right? So having the sea breeze, being at the crux of sort of the Indus Delta, having the mangroves on one side and the Balochistan Desert on the other side. So how do some of these different aspects interact? And, you know, really, what do you see as kind of the critical threats to a city like Karachi going forward as well?
Okay, so that's quite a question. And, you know, it starts with talking about the weather. So let's talk about the weather. So our climate change is really about, a few things. So heat is definitely one of them. So if you look at the data from the previous years, not only have day temperatures increased by about a degree or degree and a half over the last 20, 25 years, but the nighttime temperatures have also, so the low during the 24 hours, that has also increased by about a degree. And what that shows is that when there is no electricity, and you have to sleep in at least, you know, temperature is your nighttime temperature is 29 degrees. That, you know, in a humid environment becomes like 37, 38. And you can't sleep in that. It's simple as that. It will keep you awake. So these kind of situations did not arise earlier, even from my childhood. People used to sleep, you know, on their, they used to pull out, you know, chalpais outside in the open, and used to sleep there very easily, or on their rooftops, just like, you know, usual. But with the city after partition, the population exploding, climate change bringing in also the use of fossil fuels. So fossil fuels, when they're burnt, whether it's kerosene or gas or coal or wood, which also gets burned quite frequently in our settlements, we get heat. And increasingly, because the city is now more and more concrete, so it warms up like an oven. And especially those buildings which are made of concrete, and people are, you know, there's only one ceiling separating them from the sky and the sun. Those ceilings remain hot till after like midnight. And once again, literally, your house becomes unlivable, really. That temperature for Karachiites is an update, because, you know, when you're in a kind of a village setting and more a traditional setting, maybe your house is built differently. Maybe you know what to do. Maybe you know you can go take a dip or something. But and work stops during the day. After like 10 o'clock in the morning, the farmer, you know, comes back from the field or just sits and have his lunch. But we don't have that concept of a break at all in Karachi. And it's there in the Middle East, but we don't have it. So I think there is a behavioral change that also needs to be done. So right now, I imagine the labor is like boiling away in the 40 degrees, you know. So heat is definitely a big one. The next one is water. And water can come from many sites. So there's the sea. We can get a tsunami, and the mangroves are a great have a damping kind of effect on that. And that same thing goes for storms or cyclones, as we call them. Then there is, like in 2010, we had the flood from the river, the Indus River. So at that time, it had rained a lot in Afghanistan and KPK, and that system had come from Ukraine. So that system rained here in the north of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it all came down Punjab and Sindh. And, it was a huge, huge disaster. And we were not prepared for it. And that's another kind. And then the recent one, 2022, what we had was the rains happened somewhere else. So in Balochistan, and then the water just flowed down. Into and through Karachi. So it literally, you know, because Karachi's drainage system is, you know, pretty flawed and not maintained. And, you know, so yeah. So basically, the water flowed through our streets, you know, and our houses, and that's what happened. So, you know, so that's flood. And then, you know, related things are like, okay, where's the food going to come from? And, you know, so it's related to agriculture because such a huge city needs food. So there's few food security issues there also.
No, thank you, Amy. I think you've touched upon some very interesting themes, particularly when you talked about nighttime temperatures and being able to sleep outside kind of in our early years. I mean, you could still fall asleep. I remember this also as a child. Sometimes there was no electricity and we would just, you know, open the windows and kind of try to power through the night. But I feel like maybe my tolerance levels have gone down or just generally it's hotter than it used to be, but it's just not possible anymore. And I think this really brings us to our next theme, which is, you know, the difference between how low-income neighborhoods deal with these situations and how high-income neighborhoods deal with the same situations, right? So, of course, let's say the electricity goes out in a low-income area of the city. Probably they don't have access to backup power or to, you know, UPS systems or alternates, right? I mean, basically they're dependent on the connections to the grid. Probably they can't afford even solar panels for their rooftops. So this is where I think, you know, these income inequalities come in. And then you also touched upon sort of the impacts of water, right? So, I mean, of course, flooding is a big thing. And I feel like sometimes the water is diverted, particularly to low-income areas rather than the high-income areas. People who are able to, of course, deal with these situations, have the resources, who have access, who have networks and contacts, they are able to deal with some of these climate-related disasters in a better way. So could you perhaps, you know, just describe basically, like in your experience, what are you seeing? Like how can low-income communities cope better or like what can be done to kind of prepare them better for some of these incoming climate impacts that we, you know, have seen have happened already in Karachi, but perhaps going forward, how could they be better prepared to do like this?
It's a very crucial question that you're asking. And unfortunately, I don't have a good answer, good in the sense, a reassuring answer to that one. Because when you say that, you know, a whole city is suffering from X, Y, Z, what that means is that, that you know, the city government has planned for it adequately. And there's a failure on the part of city systems when the whole city is drowning or there is massive electricity cuts, even though we have excess electricity in the country. So why is this happening? So yes, it's exactly our institutions which are at fault. It's a failure of government, and it's failure of our style of government, which is authoritarian. And they make they're very happy bureaucrats making policies behind closed doors without consultation. And, you know, the way that our government institutions have really crumbled, they are unable to actually benefit the residents of the city through their policies. So this is such an utter failure because, you know, our institutional failure. Basically, the government does not anymore intend to benefit the public. They intend 80%. To do projects, take their permissions, and, you know, not even evaluate those. So this is first-hand information from, let's say, the planning and development department. They don't evaluate their projects because if they evaluate them, they'll have to do something right. And so we'll have to plan right. And then they say they don't have data. So the whole process is broken and flawed. And it's because there is no transparency, there is no oversight. And all of this is, you know, allowed to happen. So I think the biggest fault is the government. It has to give a system. If it gives a system, for example, to separate trash, and then there is a separate collection for trash, you have to put that into place first. You know, people can't do that at a city scale by themselves. So I think In sector after sector, whether it's water or drainage, you know, it's these big systems. It's the road, the highway. It's big systems that it's the responsibility of the government to fulfill those basic needs which are not being met. So, my long question is this, but I think situating this geographically is also very interesting. So, and there comes the power element, the asymmetry. So there is the mass city. More than half the people, 60%, live in unplanned areas, which is Kachiabadis. So what are services like in the Kachiabadis? So it's like, you know, to begin with, you're disadvantaged. And then you can say a privileged class. You know, in ordinary language, we say pull ke paar, you know, is paar ya us paar. And it's so it's stuck because you see most of the people, and then you see some people who are having the time of their lives. At the same time, so there is that geographical difference between localities, but geographical, and then if you take each sector, each sector, it's slightly different situation. So if you take water, for example, so you won't find water, you'll have to get water through tankers in Orangi, but also at DHA.
So
exactly.
But
on the other hand, if you look at electricity, there is literally a targeting of poor people happening. So when you do have electricity, but you are targeting those areas where they are low-income families, and in 40 degree plus heat, you give them 12 hours plus of scheduled load shedding. What that means is that the heat was brought in by climate change, and you're punishing them. And so this is the climate justice issue, which affects their health negatively. This is so severe. And the electricity is there, but the people can't pay for it because the electricity is so expensive. So this is related to heat on that account. So, okay, electric has these seven areas in the city, which are called high loss areas. And high loss means that it's a monetary loss because the people are so poor, they can't pay for it. There is definitely an element there. And they're able to actually negotiate with our utility company to get a certain area free of load shedding because they become this middleman who collects 2,000 rupees from each house and then pays off, someone in the utility company. And so within those low-income areas, there are these people who don't want to pay anything. And, run their AC on like 2,000 rupees a month while they don't get loads in it. While the same people in the same locality who actually pay have to suffer the breakdowns, at the same time. So this kind of system, how do you untangle that? So the solution that we propose, for example, on that one, and we are continuing to talk to K Electric on that one, is that K Electric will be able to give up some of these areas. And we will be able to give them cheap electricity if we set up renewable mini grids, because the electricity price is high because of other reasons. But solar is so cheap now, renewable energy is so cheap that K Electric does not have to give them electricity. Cheap electricity is already there. So you have to kind of facilitate that, through finance and through arrangements. In fact, in this year, we are seriously going to pursue that. We're going to do some pilots with mini grids to give some of these areas an option to just cut off their electric connection and be off grid. And so at a whole neighborhood level. So let's say, 100 houses, 1,000 houses, and hopefully we can do that through grants. So that's another one. Yeah.
Sounds really interesting. I was actually going to come to the opportunities, that exist for the private sector. Yeah. Then I think, mini grids, they have, we're seeing the solar revolution happening in Pakistan. Like last year, we imported almost half our generation capacity in the form of solar panels. I think it was around 15 to 18 megawatts. So definitely, that sort of revolution is already happening, and not just among low-income households, but of course, even the relatively high-income categories as well, who are going towards still for the most part, and then maybe during the nighttime if they're not investing in let's say backup battery storage. So, I mean, I guess what you're saying is that solutions already exist and there are ways to sort of, develop some level of resilience for the low-income society by ideally partnering with the private sector. Or you mentioned grants as well.
Yeah.
So, of course, climate finance is a huge potential that we need to tap as a country and, of course, as communities as well. I mean, there's been a lot of dialogue on policies that are supportive of, this sort of like public-private partnership or even like a grants-based model, particularly targeting low-income parts of society. Overall, do you think there's been any significant policy focus on addressing the spatial vulnerabilities in cities? So, I mean, you mentioned the floods that happened in 2010. And of course, almost like 10, 11 years later, a disaster of similar proportions basically happened across the country. Do you think we actually learned from like previous disasters? Do you think we're in a better place today to deal with some of these? Because I think at least when it comes to something like the heat waves, right, there was some level of awareness that's now been created. Hospitals are better able to, manage the influx of patients, at least diagnose and treat some of these cases of heat stroke, extreme, heat events. Because there is some level of awareness now, at least among the medical community, in terms of like awareness among people. When it comes to like other types of climate disasters, like how do you think, policies can better address some of these expected or even unexpected climate impacts that we're probably going to see in the future?
I'm really embarrassed to say that our disaster management agencies completely failed in 2010 and also in 2022, people don't even know that in 2023 there were rains again in Sindh, and the Sindh government refused to call it a disaster prone area. Then the whole areas in Badin were underwater. So if I start on this, I would say that yes, they had policies. So the policy document for disaster management, provincial disaster management, or the National Disaster Management Authority were great. They included everything. So it's like, because what you have to do is to prepare for these disasters. So you have to have the boats if there's a flood, you have to have a plan for cooled places so that people can take refuge when it's really, really hot and so on. So cooling infrastructures, or you go trees over like 10 years, to do that. So when you're not doing any of that, and then you have this plan, and then you also take out the money that is allocated for that plan, and when the disaster strikes, you have no money. This is what happened in 2022. So I don't know what to do. Tear my hair out. What should I do? So this is like utter failure on the part of, again, our government. There's I don't know what to say about such kind of stealing of public money. I mean, and that disaster money. I mean, disaster can be avoided if you know what to do. In most cases, so you can actually have a plan of evacuating people or something. But when you don't have it, then it's the people who take the brunt of it, and that's what we did. So there were 30 million people who were affected. Obviously, a disaster, a disaster of this proportion due to rains or something was not caused by the government, but it was caused by something larger, which is climate change. But we could have prepared for it. Our disaster management sort of came into being with the earthquakes in northern Pakistan in, 2005. And ERA was formed, and they had databases and everything. Even now, they have databases. They have very useful databases. Data is another subject we can talk about. But our disaster management agencies utterly failed. And then there was just people wading through water, coming onto high roads, and just encamping there. And nobody went to ask in the small towns for days. You know, so the government showed up after, I don't know, a week in some places. So, I mean, what else? What else does the failure of disaster management look like?
So, although I understand what you're saying, like in terms of, let's say, governance failures, but do you think there are opportunities for community-led disaster preparedness? Because, I mean, I'm seeing in certain other areas of Pakistan, communities themselves have sort of mobilized to develop kind of emergency management plans, you know, install early warning systems, particularly in the northern areas where you have things like the glacial lake outburst floods. They already know the kinds of measures they need to take in case, you know, such a flood occurs or there's, you know, any kind of climate disaster. So do you think similar interventions could possibly be deployed in, you know, these flood affected communities in and around, let's say, the, you know, low-lying areas, like having an emergency management plan in place, or, I don't know, developing better health infrastructure or emergency management infrastructure? Yes, of course, it would not be as efficient as, you know, having it be done through public authorities. But, I mean, what can people do to make their own situation better, let's say, you know, without any intervention from the authorities?
So, I mean, it should be no surprise that, you know, when you drown in every rain, so people start taking action, and community leaders, they kind of get the community together and tell everybody what to do in case the water comes. So they store their documents in, like, you know, plastic thalia. They store them at a place where they can, you know, easily take them and run. They tell all the kids where to go in case, you know, something happens. This kind of community training is happening, and completely community-based. Caritas is one organization which does it. They've done it in their own community, which is the Christian community, but also with villages in Gadar. They train them. We need that training in DHA also. You know, what to do in case this happens, what to do in case this happens. And so you have this, you practice those drills of what to do, like what to do in case of fire, for example, if it's a building. So people have just, you know, people are way ahead. The only actor that's missing is the government. Everybody is putting their, you know, whatever they can into it because it's survival. Government is not going to come and help them. So they've devised their own ways of doing it. But then there is a mass of people who just kind of, you know, are also unprepared.
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Like, this isn't necessarily segregated to any part of the city. Even in somewhat affluent areas, I know people whose entire basements were flooded, you know, during the urban flooding event that happened a couple of years back. You know, the cars were flooded. So it's not something. And yes, it is, of course, you know, getting more severe year on year. Of course, when a year's worth of rain falls within 2 days, this isn't, you can't say, okay, this is, you know, someone's fault. But preparedness is, I think, the only thing we can really focus on, and how to bounce back better after an event like this. What adaptation or adaptive urban planning strategies can be implemented to build climate resilience in, you know, Pakistan's rapidly expanding cities? And this is not just Karachi, of course. Now we're seeing smaller cities like, you know, Hyderabad expanding massively, you know, areas in Kotki, areas in, I mean, other parts of the country as well, not just Sindh, but of course the population is expanding. Agricultural land, unfortunately, is being replaced by, you know, housing societies and things like that. So, I mean, just from an urban planning perspective, how can we, I mean, what should we really keep in mind to ensure that, you know, yes, of course, we can't stop development from happening, but how can we do it in a way that is more disaster resilient? And now that we have some knowledge of the kinds of impacts to expect.
I think that's great learning on our part of how to navigate the future, really, and to take steps in time to prevent larger disasters. And so, if we are talk, so let me talk about little, you know, just in brief, what we need to do for flooding and what we need to do for heat. So, and then I'll come to the real problem. So for flooding, you know, you have to predict which side, you know, the water is coming from. And because the city is like up and down, so there are, Sadr is like supposed to be lowland, and so water will accumulate there. So there is the hydrology of the city. So that the natural landscape, you know, it's at the foothills of the Balochistan Mountains. So if it rains on the mountains, all of that comes here. you know, the Saadi town and everything. So that whole mass of water then comes into Karachi and from North Nazimabad side as well. And once it does, then the whole city, you know, just starts floating. What this tells me simply is that there need to be channels for the water, and that water channels should lead to places where you have made arrangements so that that water goes into the earth, because it is clean water. It is the Meetha Pani. It is not sanitation water. Unfortunately, since the 80s, Karachi KWSB, KWSB Water Board, they started connecting sewerage systems to your stormwater drainage systems. So they polluted the stormwater drainage systems, which then went into our two rivers, which is Malir and Lyari Nadi, or the Lyari Nadi and Malir Nadi. And so we put our sewage into our natural, you know, clean Meetha Pani Wali bodies. And that's going into the sea for, you know, a city the size of Karachi, right here. In fact, it's happening with every city in Pakistan. Every city lets its sewage into the river, because it's all cities are built on rivers. So they take that water, drink that water, and then they also, you know, release the bad water, wastewater. So you see, the problem gets more complex. So the simple answer to the serious problem is that you have to treat it locally. So your neighborhood should be able to clean that water, not some central plant somewhere. It's just impossible now. And you have to separate it from your stormwater channels. And then how the stormwater channel will work throughout the city is that, for example, water would be led into parts where it would accumulate and sink into the earth. This, you know, it's like rainwater harvesting. So you make a system which does that all year long, and you will replenish the water under Karachi. And of course, the trend is to just concretize. And so people are really excited about trees and planting trees. So there have been instances where they've broken the concrete to make a hole to plant trees, you know, in the inner city, and that's lovely. But there's not enough, and not as organized as the government can make it. So these are individual efforts, sometimes big, sometimes small. Flooding, you need to have a plan where the water goes to where it should be going, and you have to separate the sewage from. But the other problem with that is that when the water flows through your channels, your channels are all blocked. And why are they blocked? They're blocked with sewage. They're blocked with solid waste, which is your plastic and your cartons and, you know, all kinds of garbage. That's household garbage and sometimes industrial garbage. Small enterprises also include it. And why are they throwing garbage here? It's because the garbage does not get picked up. If the only, you know, 40% or 50% of your garbage is getting picked up, what's happening to the rest? So either you burn it, you know, you pollute the air, and what's left, you throw it in the river. And this is normal practice, or you just, you know, extract whatever you can from that, and then, you know, it's just like you throw it in the river. And that chokes the whole city again. So you can see how solid waste now is affecting your drainage. So, you know, it's all interconnects. So on one hand, you have to, you know, do the separation of solid waste and have separate systems for them. This is like decades of neglect on the part of government to maintain these systems. All of these systems are broken. Okay. So flooding, heating, because it heats up, now you have to cool the city. So that obviously means wherever there are pedestrians, you have to have tree cover or some other kind of cover so that, you know, you walk. So in the inner city, in Sadar, you must have all your streets should be tree lined. Then what you do is there are so many. So just KMC, Karachi Metropolitan Corporation, has 1,600 parks. Half of those are just bare ground. They can make urban forests in them. In fact, our plan is to make 10,000 forests. And I think we have those, half of those spaces would be from government, and half of the spaces are like universities, but they have huge reduced properties in private persons. And so if we make a comprehensive plan, and you know, the few urban forests that we have, we've learned a lot. They do not need water, because water is taken from your gutter, it's cleaned in a pond through biological means, and then that's used for the water. So it doesn't take city water. So you see, we are, you know, the way we think is completely different. We know the solutions. We know exactly how to solve each problem. And so when somebody says, "Hey, inka kuch nahi ho sakta," so we get cross at that, because, you know, we wouldn't have started what we've started at CHC if we were not optimists. And, you know, we can see technologically you can do it, but the hurdles are all institutional. I mean, the government, you know.
Yeah, so, absolutely. No, I think what I'm hearing from you is just like some frustration that, you know, the solutions exist technologically, it can be done. And of course, you know, in my experience, I've seen cities that are a lot more dense than Karachi even, which somehow function pretty well, even in extreme sort of climate events, climate disasters. I mean, I think probably if 100 lives are lost in a city like Karachi, maybe, you know, one or two people might suffer from like, you know, bad impacts during a disaster of similar proportions. So I think it's just also how well you implement some of these solutions that you're talking about. I think one thing we didn't maybe touch upon was kind of the post-disaster impacts. You know, you mentioned food security as one of them, but last year, for example, and this is a conversation I've had with some other experts as well, the flourishing of diseases that are happening more and more frequently, and particularly in low-income communities where there's, you know, water lying around, there's a sudden kind of upsurge in diseases like dengue and chikungunya. The dengue season is increasing. There used to be one, now there are two. So these are all things that we're seeing as well. And do you think urban planning has a role in addressing some of these issues as well? I mean, you mentioned solutions like, you know, separation of your stormwater and your sewage drains, having, let's say, you know, ponds to filter the water, lining your roads with trees. Are there solutions that exist for addressing the upsurge in vector-borne and waterborne diseases, from an urban planning standpoint?
Yes. So I was saying that COVID taught us a lot, and it taught us about how to protect ourselves. Everyone can do that. And when you have bad air quality like Lahore and like Karachi, the infection spreads more rapidly. This was also a learning during COVID. And it's also the reason why we have so much infection with, you know, in children in schools, and why it spreads so much in winter, because the air is worse, and it the particles, so to say, have vehicles. The viruses get transport as, you know, in the form of particles, so they can move around faster. So ek to ye baat ho gayi. So because our air quality is so bad, so we need to do some of the same things that we did during COVID, and that will reduce the spread of infection, especially in winters, and if there is another epidemic. So for buildings, it means you need proper ventilation. You just can't have closed rooms, even if you have ACs. So HVAC systems, they mix in, I think, about 50% fresh air into a building because you need the fresh air. So there are learnings like that. On the other side, from an urban perspective, the way that you find out if there is a disease in a certain area is that you test the water samples from the sewage. So you can find polio there, you can find COVID there, you can find a whole set of diseases. And when our water is so bad, and when I say so bad, I mean that the Liari Mali rivers have industrial waste in them, they have sewage in them, and people are growing vegetables from them, they are consuming that water, their animals are consuming that water. So one would expect the health situation to be disastrous. And yes, the people living along the Mali River, they have diarrhea, Children have diarrhea constantly. Then they have typhoid. And, you know, some of the nutrition, I was talking to people in HANDS and other agencies. The nutrition program, which is a separate program to supplement, you know, nutritional needs for children, failed because the diarrhea was so persistent, they couldn't absorb anything. So you see, it gets compounded and compounded. And but the way to you know, get that data is from the water, and so you can see that there is a certain area, geographic area, and you know, in medicine, this is not a new technique.
Of course, some of the
plagues during the 17th century, the plagues, let's say in London, they found out that it was confined to all the deaths were happening right next to the river. And this was the reason, because all the sewage was going into the river and just, you know, contaminating everything. So if your river is clean, the city will be clean. If your river is dirty, you know, so your health will be... how it affects ordinary people? Your health cost goes up. You might not even be able to treat yourself. You don't have that money. Then people who can afford it, you know, why are their incomes going into this expense? Of health expense, and so it's an economic burden also. And then when you're not healthy, how will you be able to put your 100% into your work and perform? So, you know, it's a vicious cycle, and this has to be reversed. It can be reversed.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a very important point, that, you know, typically everything is connected. And as you mentioned, if your water is dirty, then of course it has impacts for your health, for your economic well-being. It's a sunk cost for a lot of families who can't afford basic healthcare. So I think, like, one of the lessons I'm taking away, at least, is that, you know, when we do urban planning, we need to take into account a lot of different things. We can't just focus on, like, one solution in isolation. We have to think about the entire ecosystem as a whole, and then have maybe the different departments, different authorities speak to each other before, you know, making these policies or these plans in isolation. Mm-hmm. So definitely one of the key takeaways. Thank you so much, Yasir, for your insights. This was it was a great learning experience for me as well. That brings us to the end of our session. Thank you.